I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of March, and it's time for All Things Political. Lisa Mascaro is our guest this hour, political journalist, congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, also the Chicago Tribune and the Las Vegas Sun-Times. This is the final week for Americans to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. The president has been appearing on TV programs that he hopes has a lot of young viewers, putting special emphasis on getting young people to sign up. How's everything going? The crisis in Crimea tops the congressional agenda this week, says our guest, with lawmakers expected to consider measures to sanction Russia and expedite up to $1 billion in loans to the new government in Ukraine. The extension of unemployment insurance, the Republican budget being crafted by Congressman Paul Ryan, the National Rifle Association's problem with President Obama's nominee for Surgeon General. Those are just a few of the issues we'll be covering. Feel free to add to that list in whatever way you would like. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hello, Lisa. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Crisis in Crimea, you say, tops the congressional agenda this week. What's Congress going to be voting on or deciding on concerning that crisis?
Right. Well, you know, Congress has been on recess. They've been away all for the past week. And so the lawmakers are returning to town this week. And they left this whole business unfinished before they went out for their break at the end of the week before. You know, the House had passed a measure that would provide a loan package, loan guarantees up to $1 billion to help the new government in Ukraine. The Senate is adding on to that a bunch of sanctions, punitive sanctions on Russian officials, essentially sort of backing up the sanctions that President Obama, the administration, has already done by, you know, the administration did this by executive order. So tonight here in the Senate, senators are returning and they will take a first key vote on this package from the Senate. It was approved in a bipartisan vote out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee before they went on recess, but it has run into resistance. There is a group of Republicans led by Senator Ted Cruz, but joined by Senator Rand Paul and a few other senators who are objecting to parts of the provisions. I can get into this a little more fully, but basically they're taking it not from a foreign policy point of view so much as a sort of budget hawk point of view. So there is, you know, this widespread sort of agreement in both the House and the Senate that they would like to follow up on what the president has done with the sanctions on the Russian officials, but also provide some aid to, like I said, the new Ukraine government. But again, you know, Congress always finds itself getting in these partisan tangles.
Right.
They're in another one right
now.
Yeah,
which is interesting when it comes to this issue, because you would think on foreign affairs issue they would be of one mind that they're going to reprimand Russia and they're going to do it in a way that's significant. Instead, they're kind of fighting about it. What does that say?
Yeah, you know, it is really a changed atmosphere up here, and we saw this a little while ago, you know, a year or 2 years ago when the president was first, you know, considering what he was going to do back in Libya. You remember during the whole Arab Spring and all the situations of unrest in the Middle East. And then more recently, last year, around September, over Syria and whether the U.S. was going to get involved in Syria. And you really saw the partisan divisions rear up. You know, and this is not a new, of course, you know, we saw that a bit during the, especially the end of the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, when Democrats really became much more concerned about, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and started voicing more opposition to those wars than they had in the beginning, you know, when they had given the administration clearance to, you know, to sort of engage in those battles. But you do see more tumult around these issues now, and criticism, you know, the sort of outward criticism of the president that I think for, you know, listeners, you know, probably thinking back to earlier days, you know, you maybe didn't see that kind of attitude from the lawmakers.
We had a guest last week who said the executive order sanctions are really minuscule and will do virtually nothing. Is that the kind of reaction you're getting from members of Congress as well, that these aren't very meaningful executive
sanctions?
Well,
you know, I think initially that was definitely the concern. The administration has now done three rounds of sanctions, and I think this third round that came last Thursday, folks see as being more broad in scope and perhaps having slightly more teeth than the others. That said, there are plenty of those who think that these sanctions still don't go far enough and that the U.S. should be considering, you know, something even broader, sort of the, you know, looking at what the U.S. has done in Iran, for example. We heard some conversations about that on the talk shows on Sunday. You know, right now Congress is not in that position. Right now what Congress is looking at is sort of backing up what the president has done and sort of codifying, which means putting into law these executive orders, which means that for the White House, they can't sort of turn these sanctions on and off at their will. What the House is considering in its bill this week on sanctions would put the sanctions that the administration has imposed into law and require the president to report back to Congress and say, you know, when he is ready to turn the sanctions off, you know, when the president is ready to turn the sanctions off, why and what progress has been made, and really do a full accounting before those just start and stop. So that really is, you know, you can see the legislative branch trying to exert its authority over the president.
Let's talk, move to unemployment benefit extension that would affect more than 2 million jobless Americans. You had this bipartisan agreement among 10 senators. Is the Senate likely to vote for their plan, and then the problems will be in the House?
Yeah, so that is next up once they get rid of the Ukraine legislation. So we might see some action on unemployment later in the week, or probably more certainly into next week. You know, this is a constant battle here in Congress, and even though you have these 10 senators, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, coming to an agreement, there is still widespread divisions within the Republican Party over whether or not to continue jobless benefits. There are those who say that these jobless benefits just really are, you know, not helpful in getting people back to work, or providing, you know, a bit of a conducive to keeping people out of work, and that's just a divide. The Senate looks like it will have the votes to push that through, but absolutely it will run into difficulty in the House. And, you know, what you see here is really these geographic and regional divides. The Republicans, who come from the hard-hit unemployment states, are leaning into this issue. You know, the senator from Nevada, the senator, I'm trying to have my list in front of me here, but some of the higher hit unemployment rates, where the jobless rate remains well above the national, you know, 6.7% average, are the ones really backing this, because they see the need in their states. The others, you know, others are less inclined because they see a sort of philosophical opposition. I will say Democrats have really changed on this issue too. I mean, there was a time when jobless benefits were provided by the government. These are the extended long-term benefits for people once your state benefits run out. So most states provide about, you know, 6 months worth of benefits. This is the extension of, you know, benefits for another period of time. So these are the long-term unemployed, but the federal government had always provided these benefits in times of high unemployment, and it's in recent years that those benefits, there's been requirements that the government backfill the costs of those benefits by cutting, you know, from the budget elsewhere. That's been something that sort of in the austerity times of the Republican priorities up here that Democrats had to come along and agree to. So you're seeing that change now from the Democrats. They're willing to go ahead and pay for these benefits with cuts elsewhere in a way that they wouldn't have done in the past.
Let's switch to Nate Silver for a moment. There are reports today that the Democrats are highly worried because the young and pretty accurate statistician is saying that he thinks the GOP will retake the Senate in November's election. Republicans need 6 seats to regain control. He says exactly 6 seats will be won, although it's a little bit early to say this definitively. How are Democrats responding to that? I know they must be.
Oh, yeah. You know, Democrats are increasingly worried about the midterm elections. A lot of it revolves around, you know, the health care law, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and just the general unease in the populace over the economy and the job situation. I think the conventional wisdom is that, yeah, at least 4 Democratic-held seats right now in the Senate are likely to fall to Republicans. We can go through some of those if you want, but, you know, that's in sort of, you know, West Virginia, where longtime Senator Jay Rockefeller is retiring. That state is, you know, fairly conservative. It does not seem likely that the voters there will choose a Democrat to replace him, but likely a Republican. Similar in South Dakota, where Senator Tim Johnson is retiring. It doesn't look like a Democrat will be able to hold on to that seat. Senators are concerned about Montana, where longtime Senator Max Baucus just left to go become the ambassador to China. There's now a government-appointed Senator John Walsh was appointed to fill that seat, a Democrat, but he faces a tough, re-election climate there in a state that, you know, is more conservative. So those you can see are these right off the bat sort of some losses that get you into close to 6, you know, those 6 seats. A number of other senators are in difficult reelections. So we will see some, like Senator Mary Landrieu down in New Orleans. Yes, she's a Democrat, and it's a tough climate for her. But she has a very strong brand in that state. You know, the Landrieu family is known. They've been in politics a long time. So, you know, I don't think folks are ready to sort of count someone like her out, even though she does face a very difficult reelection and is probably most certainly one of those on Nate Silver's list.
Mm-hmm. And what is the issue, Lisa, that may win it for the Republicans? Is it really the Affordable Care Act? And if so, what are they campaigning on, that they're going to repeal it, which is not really going to happen as long as the president is in office?
You know, that is a really good point. The Republicans have never really answered the repeal and replace question. They've always said, well, let's repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act with something better. You see, House Republicans for almost a year now have been sort of meeting to come up with an idea of what that replace would look like. And there are certainly lots of ideas that could have widespread appeal on what some of the alternatives could look like. The problem is, you know, getting consensus, not only between Democrats and Republicans, but also, you know, within the Republican Party, which, as everyone knows, is very divided right now. You know, they're having their own sort of internal problems of how conservative to make the party, which you see by some of the national leaders. So, yes, I mean, to answer your question, I think Republicans are also torn in how to campaign. They want to tap into voter disapproval of the Affordable Care Act, and that is out there. You know, polls show that people don't really like it. But they are divided. The Republicans are divided over how much they need to lean into alternatives and show people an alternative. Because some in the party say, look, you know, there was an election last year where Mitt Romney tried to make the election a referendum on President Obama and his policies. And, you know, Governor Romney, the Republican nominee, didn't win that election. And so there are some in the Republican Party that say, hey, we really need to show alternatives. And you see people like Leader Cantor, the majority leader in the House. He's the Republican from Virginia. And, you know, when you see Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, and Congressman Paul Ryan, you know, going around the country trying to throw out alternatives, trying to capture sort of a broader swath of voters. But again, within the party, there are divisions of sort of how they are best situated to campaign and whether they should be, you know, more fully embracing some of these ideas that some of those party thinkers are throwing out there.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest for All Things Political this Monday is Lisa Mascaro. She's a congressional correspondent, the congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Las Vegas Sun-Times. We've been talking about the crisis in Crimea, what Congress will be voting on. Nate Silver's prediction that the Senate will, that the Republicans need 6 votes, and they will probably get them in the November midterm election to switch the Senate from Democratic to Republican. I want to talk about this issue with the National Rifle Association's problem with President Obama's nomination for Surgeon General. Evidently, he has said that that guns should be a public health issue in this country, that as a doctor, he has seen too many people in emergency rooms suffering from gunshot wounds, spinal cord injuries, et cetera, and it needs to be a part of the conversation in this country. And that's enough for the NRA to say, we don't want this guy. And at least 10 Democrats, reports are saying, agreeing, because they come from states where the NRA is very, very strong. What do you think about that? What does she think about that? What's going on with that issue? So here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening now to All Things Political, and we're welcoming phone calls for the L.A. Times congressional reporter Lisa Mascaro. 800-486-8655 is the number. Jim in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Today I'd like to talk about cheating and learning and keeping in touch with things, and also framing. And, my dad was a Bob Taft Republican. And I think I and a lot of the older people, especially the men that listen to the show, know that it's not necessary to cheat to win, and that things have really gotten out of hand. And so to keep in touch with this, we got to keep reading as widely as possible so we can learn about things. The Milwaukee Journal today, for example, has a good article on the Koch brothers targeting Chamber of Commerce people, of all people, up north. And Bill Maher, of course, talks about the in his new rules, always has good things about the use of words and how they're used to manipulate people. And, you know, when we think about it, for example, with the vote with black voters, all the way from Korea on up, black men have fought in wars, but apparently they don't deserve to vote. And the Republicans talk about using the N-word to keep people from voting, but in actuality what they want to do is use a bogus issue like voting rights to detract from it. And, why imagine a man from rural Elroy, a white man, who had to stay up to 1 in the morning like black voters had to do in Florida. If they looked at it that way as a human rights issue, they'd look at things differently. So we have to bring the realities across to people and reframe things.
Thanks very much, Jim, for the call. Let's center on the voting issue for a moment. There was a decision you may not be aware of because you don't live here in Wisconsin. The legislature did away with early voting in the state of Wisconsin, and there's been a bit of an uproar among Democrats, particularly in city areas where large numbers of people vote, and they feel that it's going to keep minority voters who tend to vote Democratic from voting. Then we've got the appeal of voter ID in this state, and a decision could come down on that, on a couple of court decisions on that. Take on the issue, though, of voting in this country and how it may play into the midterm elections. Are a lot of these, as some would see them, more restrictive rules for voting, voter ID, et cetera, tied up in the courts, so they won't make much of a difference? Or do you think they will play into the midterm elections?
Well, you know, that's interesting, and I'm probably not the best on that, although I know some states, their new voter ID requirements will be going into effect for this midterm. In Mississippi, there's a new requirement that will be happening, and I'm not sure the situation that's happening out in North Carolina, which is sort of at the forefront of this issue. But I will say, you know, it is very interesting on these midterm elections because Democrats do not turn out in the numbers that Republicans turn out. And it is something that you have heard President Obama speak very forcefully about, is if you sort of listen to some of his stump speeches, especially in some of these fundraisers that he's been attending for Democrats. This concern you had asked earlier, you know, how concerned are Democrats? They're very concerned that their voters will not be turning out, because history shows us and polls show us that that is in fact true for midterm elections. Democrats are more energized when there is a president on the ballot. And one of my colleagues here at the Times has a story on today's front page, which folks could look at, that talks a little bit about the Tea Party, but buried in the story was a very interesting statistic about energy among the Republican voters, and that the Tea Party, sort of those identified as conservative or Tea Party, were far more energized. I want to say the number was something like 74%, you know, were closely watching this coming midterm election, compared to, you know, much lesser numbers on both sort of the, you know, what you might think of as sort of a mainstream Republican or the Democratic side. So that will be important, this election, of who turns out. And, you know, a lot of these campaigns have primary contests they have to get through. And, you know, those often are very, you know, slimly attended affairs. So it's something that I think both parties are really going to be trying to work on come, you know, leading into November.
Right. Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Mike in Twin Lakes. Hi. Hello, Mike. Mike is not there. Call us back, Mike. I want to talk a little bit about, and I know it was an editorial in the LA Times, your paper, yesterday, perhaps, the National Rifle Association having a problem with Dr. Murthy, who's President Obama's nominee for Surgeon General. And the editorial says it has nothing to do with his medical expertise. It's that Murthy thinks gun control is smart public policy. It goes on to say, unfortunately, too many members of the Senate share the gun lobby's skewed view of the world. It is interesting to me that they have picked this issue where he's seen, you know, he believes in guns being a public health issue, which how can you not see it that way, particularly if you're a doctor and you're treating people who have spinal injuries because of gunshots?
Right. So we've covered this issue on the news side as well the last couple weeks. And it has been a very interesting and emerging new front for the National Rifle Association. I think typically you see the NRA issue warnings about nominations for the, you know, the Justice Department, any of the sort of law enforcement agencies right underneath the Justice Department. Objection. So the National Rifle Association sent out a letter to the Senate leaders in mid-February raising these objections. And now Dr. Murthy, when he testified before his confirmation hearing, said, you know, I have no intention of sort of using this position to, you know, further these concerns or these statements that I've made on gun control. And he said, according to our reporter who covered the hearing, you know, that he was very aware of the sort of need to, you know, work on both sides of the aisle and be sort of nonpartisan in that office of Surgeon General. Of course, the Surgeon General has no real control over, you know, U.S. firearms policy. But the opposition from the NRA, I think, really signals a new front here and a way for the NRA to continue asserting itself into debates. I mean, you don't see Congress taking up any gun control legislation this year.
No, you sure don't.
You know, after Newtown, the shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, you know, senators tried and failed to get some gun control legislation through, and there is not going to be another chance, as far as we can tell, you know, anytime soon. Democrats are not interested in this issue in an election year. It doesn't help them, and they're not interested. Yet the NRA can raise the issue and sort of remind people of where the parties stand on the issue, even if there is no real legislation or, you know, issue. So I think it's interesting, and I think it'll be interesting to see if the NRA continues to pursue this this route. I mean, we'll see, you know, if there are other nominees coming down the pike in other sort of not traditionally, you know, fields not traditionally related to gun regulation that the NRA decides to weigh in on.
So, Lisa, do you think that it is fairly certain that Dr. Murthy will not be confirmed because of his position on guns?
I think that there is a likelihood that it will not come to a vote at this point. Senate aides have sort of indicated over the last couple of weeks that this is no longer an issue that the White House is pushing for a vote. And some senators' offices have sort of indicated that they are not expecting a vote. So I think that sort of tells you that were he to come for a vote, he probably would not be approved. Things can change. And, you know, senators, all lawmakers, as nervous as they might get among, you know, by some of these political groups, they also, you know, like to sort of stand up to them at times, though I don't know if maybe this one will be it. I think it probably is likely that he will not come to a vote, and if he were to come to a vote, wouldn't be confirmed.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, Mike.
All right. I've got a question, and I've heard nothing about it. You know, I'm almost 70 years old, and I'm still out here working. Good Lord willing, I'm able to, and I've got a job. But we keep cutting off benefits to our older people. We have homeless veterans. We have, you know, people that are trying to raise families. They have no jobs. And we keep asking the American taxpayer to give a little more, to sacrifice more, our citizens. And we take that money and we ship it to every foreign country around. We ship billions to Pakistan, India, Iran. Now we want to ship some more money out of this country. You know, I have not heard one senator, one congressman, anyone talk about these foreign countries, and they're going to have to tighten their belts, and they're going to have to cut back. Why is it it's always us? And, you know, I can feel sorry for some of these countries, but it's time we took care of our own people right away. First thing is cut back Medicare, cut back this. What are we? Is anyone even discussing cutting back foreign aid? I'd like to know. We have any, because I sure voted for a congressman or a senator that would do that.
All right, Mike, thanks for your thoughts. Lisa.
Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting point and really echoes the frustrations that you hear from voters across the United States on this sort of dismal economic situation that's out there. A couple of points I will say is that, you know, I as much as people like to point to the foreign aid, it really is a very small part of the federal budget. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think maybe something like 1% or even less. A lot of it is also in the form of loans. And I will say on the issue of taxes, you know, for the most part, most Americans have been seeing tax cuts during the Obama administration, whether it was, you know, from the start during the stimulus program that was put in place after the, you know, at the start of the Obama administration in 2009, at the sort of onslaught of the recession, and then, you know, more recently with continuing some of the tax breaks that were about to expire. Only the most wealthy of Americans, those, you know, earning sort of upwards of, I think it's the $400,000 range, if I'm remembering correctly, and maybe $250,000 for some of the new healthcare tax increases. So it's really the tax increases are mostly on the wealthier Americans that make up about 1 or 2%. But I think the caller really is expressing this frustration, and you know, I think a lot of people see all this money getting spent on a lot of things, and you know, people's own economic situations are hard right now.
I mean, they are hard.
Most people have not seen a wage increase, you know, in practically a decade. And, you know, it's really, I think everyone sort of sees the difficulty that Americans are having trying to keep pace and to get ahead at this point. And there's not a lot of clear answers, I don't think, coming from D.C. right now, where the government is fairly divided over how to resolve this or try to get some ideas on the board.
Jocelyn in South Milwaukee is next. Hi. Jocelyn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 2 points to make. One is about the previous thing that you talked about, the Koch brothers, all the billions of dollars that they're pouring into everything. And now recently the NRA objecting to the Surgeon General. And I think that these organizations have too much influence over creating our public policy, and I think that really waters down the value of each individual person's vote. They have too much influence, and so do the lobbyists. And I don't like the fact that there just seems to be unlimited resources to pour into those things. And I think that there should be limits on those things. And I don't understand why there aren't. And then there's another point that I wanted to make was I recently had to renew my driver's license, so I thought I'd get one of those voter ID cards with a photo on them, and they wouldn't let me have one. And I had all the documents that I thought that I needed. I had my utility bill, and I had my birth certificate and my marriage license, and the Social Security card that the Social Security Administration sent me when I notified them that I had gotten married and my last name was changed. And I had that Social Security card, and that's why they wouldn't let me get it, the voter ID card. They said, no, the Social Security card has to be blue. And mine happened to be white with blue letters, and they said it was unacceptable. And I didn't have anything with my Social Security number on it because I have direct deposit at work.
Right.
So I said, well, can I go home and get my last income tax return? And they said, no, we won't accept that. You have to go to Social Security Administration and get a blue Social Security card, and then you can come back and get your voter ID card.
But Jocelyn, do you have a driver's license, right?
I do have a driver's license, I was able to renew my driver's license. I just couldn't get the voter ID card.
Well, I may be mistaken, but I don't think you need to get a voter ID card if you have a driver's license. Am I wrong about that? I mean, you use that for your ID, that you need a ID that has your picture on it, and your license will do just...
And it was mailed to me in.
What's that?
And I said it was in the original... I had the original envelope that the Social Security Administration had mailed it to me in. And they said, no, we won't.
Okay. But if you have your driver's license, you should be just fine. But it points to the fact that people don't know exactly what they need to get these voter IDs. It's not that simple a process to get to a place and what you need to have with you. And if you have to pay to have something with you, it can be rather complicated. What about her earlier point, Lisa, of the effect of lobby groups on legislation that passes or legislation that's doomed? Does she have a valid point?
You know, we're just really in an era of a lot of money being spent by a lot of groups
right.
and way influence here, I think, in a way that has been sort of unseen in American politics. And it does have a lot of influence. It has a lot of influence on how voters understand issues through all of these outside groups that can provide, you know, education campaigns that are essentially unaffiliated with a particular candidate but are promoting a certain view. And, you know, just the influence then that groups can have on the races by, you know, pouring money into opponents. And you see that on both sides of the aisle. You see it across the board in the primaries. It is just really open season now where millions and millions and millions of dollars are being spent. And I think the frustration that the voter feels is something, again, that you hear across, you know, you go across the country and talk to voters and they echo that sentiment. And I don't see a real way around that right now. I know there are a lot of groups working on the issue. Supreme Court is always going to be, you know, they issued that key ruling a couple of years ago that did allow for more spending. And, you know, I think this is going to be a continued fight in the political realm here.
Yeah. And the excessive partisanship, which you've made mention of several times during this hour, it doesn't seem to me as though that's going to be any better in the next few years. It sort of leaves you with this, well, what have we done? What can we run on? What's been important? And you find that there's very little legislation that people have been able to get through because everybody disagrees with everybody so strongly instead of trying to compromise perhaps
that's,
a bit.
That's true. And I will, I guess, say two things. One, you know, a lot of the bipartisan or the partisanship stems from the redistricting that happens every 10 years after the census count is taken. And certain states add or others subtract their number of congressional seats based on how many people they have in their states. And you really see both parties try to use that process to shore up their incumbents. And while that's great, their incumbents get their districts, you know, lines drawn in a way that protect them more, a little more Democrat, a little more Republican. You are really seeing the end of the swing seat in these congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
The number of swing seats has declined dramatically over the last 20 years. Now there's just a few dozen left. Maybe 50 on a good day, it sort of depends. And so that is really polarizing the House. And then the broader sort of partisan landscape that you see with the moneyed interests in these different groups coming in is having a similar effect on the Senate. I will say this. I do think that politics are cyclical. I think that you see this country has ebbed and flowed in its political history, and you do see a real exhaustion up here on the Hill with lawmakers tiring of the fight and tiring of what they know is not getting done. And so I guess that might be a note out there, just that I think you see it in the Senate and you see it in the House, where legislators, they do want to legislate and they do want to, come up with solutions. And I think they are growing increasingly tired of the world they've created.
Yeah, right. And one of those issues, it wasn't that long ago, we were doing lots of shows on immigration reform, and people were agreeing on certain legislation that could possibly pass. As you have written in your piece over the weekend, absent from the House agenda is any mention of immigration reform.
Yeah. You know, boy, that was a big moment last spring when the senators got together to pass this comprehensive immigration bill. And really surprising, given the climate, it was right after the big presidential election. And in January, boy, those senators got working. They came out with a list. They, went through grueling months of amending the legislation, changing it, adding, subtracting, getting this coalition on board. So they had a fairly robust vote of, I'm trying to remember, 67 or something in the Senate. I mean, that's pretty big for this era. And, and then it landed like a thud over there in the House. And again, I think that goes a bit to that divide that you see, where the senators, of course, have to run statewide. They have more leeway to sort of be bipartisan. The lawmakers in those House districts come from more polarized districts. So many of the Republican districts have been so changed that they have such few, so many members maybe have 2% minority voters in their district. So the issues of immigration reform are just not even really, on their mind, let alone something they want to stick their neck out and vote for.
Yeah.
Anyway, and that's a big divide within the Republican Party, as we were talking about earlier, of whether they should lean into these issues as a way to broaden their party, or just, hold back because it's a way to win the next election.
Yeah. Jocelyn, thanks at any rate for your call. Tom in Madison, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to back up that other woman's story about getting a voter ID or a driver's license. When I moved here 5 years ago, I was living in Monona temporarily. I then moved into Madison. I decided to become a Wisconsin resident. I went to get my driver's license. I had my former Illinois driver's license, my lease, and a passport, and that wasn't good enough to get a driver's license with my current address on it. They would actually give me a driver's license for the place I used to live in Monona, but not the current one, because I could get a utility bill from that one. And I think I tell people about this from other states, and they just kind of shake their heads and say, well, it can't be hard. It only took me 10 minutes to get one. But that's assuming you live in a county that has a DMV, you're living in a county that has a DMV that has decent hours, your boss will let you off of work, you have transportation to get there. And I just see the whole thing as a poll tax by a party that has nothing to offer. So the only thing they have left is to keep people who would typically vote against them from voting at all.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom, for the call. I guess Tom's call and Jocelyn's call points to the fact that if you want to get a voter ID or if you want to get a driver's license, you better look up and see what all the qualifications are, because it's obvious that people are having problems. So that's our lesson learned. Lisa Mascaro is our guest this hour, and we're talking all things political, which we do every Monday at 1 o'clock. She's congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Las Vegas Sun-Times, and other newspapers. We are we haven't talked that much about some of these other issues, so we'll have to get to them. Congressman Paul Ryan, she wrote in her piece yesterday, has been looking at the Republican budget. He's crafting it, and it's expected to, as Lisa writes, dramatically reduce federal outlays on Medicare, Medicaid, and other safety net programs to balance the budget within the decade. We'll look at what's in that and how it's being received in the country, and welcome more of your phone calls. A couple questions I'm really interested in your response to. What about this idea that the GOP will take the Senate in November? What are the issues that are going to drive the Republicans to the polls, that are going to drive the Democrats to the polls? Democrats don't vote. Republicans always vote. Democrats vote less often. You know, things have to be right for them, and weather, of course, always makes a difference for everybody, but Republicans are more reliable voters. So what issues will move people to the polls, particularly Democrats, this go around? We've talked about Crimea, your thoughts on that. Does anybody want to respond to this confirmation for the Surgeon General being blocked by the NRA because he wants guns to be a public safety issue? And anything else we've talked about, we welcome your calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, as we talk all things political, 800-486-8655. Let's talk a little bit about Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, of course. The House focused on a Republican budget that he has been crafting. What is his budget, and how does it significantly differ in terms of what a Democratic budget would be, Lisa?
Yeah, well, your voters might remember Paul Ryan there from Wisconsin. I'm sure they know him well, the former Republican vice presidential nominee and, of course, the chairman of the House Budget Committee. And he is, again, back at what has become really his signature issue, which is this balanced budget. It balances in about 10 years, and it substantially overhauls much of the nation's safety net for Medicare, which is, of course, the health insurance program for older Americans, and Medicaid, which is, the health health program for, for lower-income, primarily lower-income Americans, but also the elderly as well. And, as you can imagine, to get the budget to ballot, federal budgets run, they had been running a $1 trillion deficit. They've about halved that in recent years as the economy has improved. But the budget has been in deficit for years and years and years and years, pretty much since World War II, and except for that brief moment there when it did balance in the late 90s. So to close that, into that red ink, he would substantially sort of overhaul, like I said, these programs. That means that idea he has floated, people might remember, for changing the Medicare program into one that provides seniors with a sort of fixed amount of money for them to then go buy their own health insurance. They could buy sort of the traditional Medicare, or they could choose just a policy out there from a private insurance company, and also substantially changing, cutting the money that the federal government provides to the states to implement the Medicaid program for lower-income Americans and seniors. And these are all ways to save money, and like I said, to close that red ink. The one area that does not get so cut is the defense budget. He's always tried to sort of protect the defense budget because that is something that a lot of people in his party really agree with, sort of keeping that up to speed. The challenge that Paul Ryan is facing is that he's going to have to cut even deeper probably this year than in past years because economic growth has been so sluggish. And so the government cannot depend on all the continued increase in revenue that it gets from tax receipts when businesses are struggling, individuals are not working, people aren't paying taxes if you're not working, companies aren't paying taxes if they're not growing. So that sluggish growth is making putting a lot of pressure on how hard it will be to bring the budget into balance. And again, I think, back to what would drive folks to the polls,
I think Democrats can't wait to see the Paul Ryan budget
right.
because this
right.
for them is a sharp contrast to sort of the way that President Obama talks about, you know, taxing the wealthy as a way to provide additional benefits that can help, you know, spur growth the way the administration says by investing in, you know, industries and jobs and things that could help get the economy turned around.
Yeah.
So it's a real contrast in view.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bob in Janesville is our next caller for you, Lisa. Hi, Bob.
Hi. You were talking a little bit about what will politicians run on this year, and I can tell you what they're not going to run on. We have an entire class here in Wisconsin that we've elected over the last few years of elected politicians, elected officials that have never worked a real job. Scott, our governor has never had a job. Paul Ryan drove the Wienermobile. I don't know what Tammy Baldwin did, one of our Democratic senators. The guy she took his place, the guy that owns the Milwaukee Bucks, I don't think he ever had a real job. Nobody's going to run on real jobs. We have a culture here of part-time jobs, if there's any jobs at all, especially in southern Wisconsin. And it's a dirty little secret here. You will never hear this talked about. Everything is run with part-time labor if there's jobs at all. And that cannot support the services that we need to keep our culture working. And you will not hear anybody running on that. Because, for one thing, these guys have never worked real jobs, so they wouldn't know.
Well, there's a lot to be said for being a public servant is being a real job. And what you said isn't true, that the governor worked for, was it the American Heart Association or the Red Cross? I think it may have been the Red Cross. Certainly Herb Kohl was a very successful businessman before he became a politician very late in life. So, but his comments point to the low regard that many people do have for people who are in office, that they don't think that they
right.
have a regular kind of job. It's a telling indictment, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Again, this frustration I think voters are feeling, you're really hearing it on the show today, and I think that's very common across the country. I will say two things. You know, one thing that happened with the sort of advent of the Tea Party and their ascent into office is that it did bring in a lot of, you know, what you would say is sort of non-career politicians. You know, a lot of the new class that was elected to the House after the big 2010 Tea Party, you know, takeover were people who had never been even on a city council or a school board or any of these kinds of positions. You know, you had farmers and car lot owner. What am I trying to say? You know, the car lot owner. There was a funeral director. I mean, folks who were just sort of fed up and wanted to try it themselves and see if they could win. So you do have a lot of those folks in Congress now, which is something new or newer for Congress, something they haven't seen in a while. And then secondly, I think, you know, that issue of a part-time economy or a sort of service-based economy is definitely something that we're seeing out there with, again, the difficulty people are having trying to get ahead. It's an issue that is coming up with not only the extension of unemployment benefits, but also, you know, the president's trying to increase the minimum wage, which is an initiative that probably will not go anywhere in this Congress, though there will probably be some votes in the Senate coming up here shortly to, you know, sort of put some attention on that issue. But certainly not anything that will, that's not an issue that will have bipartisan support by any stretch. But it does get to that issue of, you know, you have people that are working 30 hours a week, even those working full time, 40 hours a week. And, you know, at $8 an hour, it's difficult to pay the rent.
Absolutely.
Pay your kids,
it's impossible.
Yeah. Pay for college even. I mean, how would you even consider paying
right.
for college? So, you know, so these are the challenges. And I think that's the economy is going through a huge shift right now. You know, we're going to really turn away from a manufacturing economy to this information and service-based economy. And it's just it's a lot of growing pains right now in the economy as it tries to figure out sort of what's going to be the next sort of way for the American, you know, business model to keep going.
Thank you, Bob, for your call. Well, Lisa, for your sake, I hope something truly remarkable happens this week and some significant piece of legislation will be talked about by both Republicans and Democrats, and agreement will be reached and everybody will be inspired.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again.
You bet. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye. Lisa Mascaro, our guest. She is the congressional correspondent for, well, it's a number of newspapers because the Tribune bought the L.A. Times. So it's the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and other Tribune bureaus. She's the congressional correspondent, and she's in the Washington Bureau for the Times. So thanks to her. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP as well for doing our on-air production. Please join us tomorrow during this time period. We're going to be looking at these safety problems with cars and regulators acting not until there were many years of deadly defects in certain GM cars, and then there's been a problem with Toyota. They settled with the government for $1.2 billion in a recall probe. Former Detroit bureau chief and senior business correspondent for the New York Times will join us.